for your new favorite band? The Austin 100 from NPR Music has 100 fresh discoveries that you can actually download for a limited time. That's 100 free songs, yours to keep, showcasing the best new artists from this year's South by Southwest Music Festival. All you have to do is visit npr.org/Austin100, and until March 31st, you can grab all 100 songs at the click of a link. Or if downloading isn't your thing, search for the Austin 100 on the NPR One app. Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. I'm here in the studio today to introduce a very special episode. I'm with Glenn Weldon of NPR's Arts Desk. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, Linda.
Well, Glenn and I are in the studio because while Stephen Thompson and a lot of other people enjoy the music of South by Southwest down in Austin, we are going to bring you a couple of segments today from our live tour from last fall, and then we're going to bring you an interview that Petra Mayer, our buddy, did with Neil Gaiman, an author you might have heard of.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Glenn, who is with us for these two live tour segments that we're going to hear first?
That would be the great and good and very, very funny Guy Branum, a comedian, podcast host. He joined us at the Now Hear This Festival in Anaheim, which was our last date on the National Pop Culture Happy Hour live tour.
That's right. And by the way, if you hear this and you think, boy, Pop Culture Happy Hour sounds like a fun live event, we should tell you that we still have tickets available for our live show in Chicago, which is on April 12th. And you can get those at nprpresents.org. And as we have already said, Sam Sanders of the formerly of the NPR Politics podcast, now of New Projects, being constantly discovered. Sam will be in our fourth chair, and we're very excited about that show. We're still booking additional folks, TBD, so we are very excited. But before we get to that, Guy Branum, who bites my act over at Pop Rocket, a podcast that we like very much, is going to talk to us about a topic very close to our hearts, and that is the topic of fads. So listen to this conversation we had with Guy Branum at the Now Hear This Fest in Anaheim. Now, we've been talking quite a bit about fads in the last couple of weeks, and Stephen, you were the one who brought this up, and I want you to explain how you got on the topic of fads, tell them what the inciting incident is.
Oh my God. You guys give me so much crap about the obsession with Pokemon Go.
Yep.
And people gave NPR so much crap about NPR's obsession with Pokemon Go. Everybody in the media was briefly obsessed with Pokemon Go, and I, like many people, like millions before me, went around and like wandering into places I shouldn't have wandered to attempt to catch...
In a non-criminal kind of way
to catch cartoon monsters. It got me thinking, like, because immediately people started talking about it like it's a fad.
Right.
And as soon as it started...
How many of y'all play Pokemon Go? Show of hands.
How many of you still play Pokemon Go? There we go.
Let the record show 3 hands raised.
Steven, you recently had an accomplishment in the game.
I did. I completed my Pokedex.
Yes.
And yeah.
For this continent.
For this continent, I've completed my Pokedex.
And then Alexander wept, for there was no world left to conquer.
Exactly right. And it feels like I'm done now. And it did reach a point where it was like, I can't wait until I have caught them all so that I can stop playing this game.
I think that's one of the reasons that it was fundamentally a fad, was that it was such a good, innovative approach to gameplay that didn't have that much gameplay behind it. I think if it had been a game that had like a good way for you to fight with other people, if there had been more complex or varied gameplay, it could have been something with the stuff to keep going.
Right.
And it was a good idea that overwhelmed us and was good, thin, and different. Like, different enough that you were excited to be playing it. It was different from other games, but thin enough that you were so quickly like, yeah, I get this.
Well, I mean, among other things, like in Pokemon, as in life, I stay away from the gyms. So, like, there's a whole layer of the gameplay that I avoid. But anyway, it got me thinking about fads.
Right.
Like, what constitutes a fad in 2016 as opposed to, say, a meme?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have your things that seem like fads and then endure. I would argue even Pokemon Go is still a successful business enterprise. It has just winnowed itself down just to obsessives.
Sure.
You came up with a taxonomy to start off this discussion, breaking it into three different fads into three different categories, which A is kind of biting my style.
Yeah,
that's
sorry,
A.
Man. Sorry,
B,
man. It won't happen again.
So I took your taxonomy and just gave the three categories cute alliterative names. Mm. So I'm taking all your work and then doing something with it. So I'm America, basically. So
branding is important.
Right. The first category is kindling, right? This is stuff that flares up and flames out very, very quickly. Back in the day, the two examples you came up with were what's up, and I didn't do that well, and and where's the beef? Both, which are advertising campaigns.
Ask your parents.
Ask your parents. So they had to last a little bit long. Nowadays, the stuff burns not in a matter of weeks or months, but in hours. So yeah. Damn Daniel, right?
Oh, my God.
The IKEA monkey in a shearling coat.
Sure.
Oh, man.
Ken Bone.
That monkey was really cute, though.
All right, let's take a moment for the IKEA monkey in a shearling coat.
That's a moment of silence.
Ken Bone, Too Many Cooks.
Yep.
David S. Pumpkins. Now.
Yeah.
I made a reference on Twitter, not to David Pumpkins, not a joke about David Pumpkins, I feel I need to specify that, but a reference to the phenomenon that is David S. Pumpkins on Monday.
Splitting hairs. Splitting hairs.
Less than 36 hours after David Pumpkins was loosed upon the world, and I felt dirty. I felt hack. I felt women be shopping. I felt, what's the deal with airline peanuts? In 36 hours. That's okay. So there's, in the music, you mentioned Gangnam Style. What does the fox say? Remember, what does the fox say?
What does the fox say? Sure.
Made that my happy in 1 week of the show, and it was a Wednesday, and I knew by Friday it'd be over. And by Friday it was over.
We taped on a Wednesday. It's like by Friday, everyone.
Speaking of Friday, Friday. The Macarena and the stanky leg you mentioned, Stephen. I don't know what the stanky leg is.
Well, you don't know what the... I had banked on several minutes
like
of material.
Like a murmur of disapproval.
That was just going to be you performing the stanky leg.
No. I don't know what it is.
Explain the stanky leg.
It's a dance. It's a dance that accompanies a song, kind of like your Soulja Boy or gotcha. You know, that there's the song that accompanies a wacky dance. And so, you know, you usually can tell that a dance like that has taken off when it briefly appears in touchdown celebrations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's the thing. Like, the other, like, Who Let the Dogs Out mm-hmm. has all the earmarks of a fad, but then it's picked up by sports, and then it's just, it goes into a different category.
Endures. Yes.
Yes.
What category is that?
Well, okay, there's still another category. The second category is, so we create kindling. Now we have campfires. They burn very hot, and then they cool, and then they go away completely.
Yeah.
Like Weakest Link, Millionaire, Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, Batman 66 experienced this as well, True Detective, and then catchphrases, like 70s comedy sitcoms had catchphrases at play, like A, not really a catchphrase.
sit on it, Potsy.
Sit on it, up your nose with a rubber hose, like
kiss
all this
stuff.
Yeah. So that's what I'm talking about. Anything that is talked about a great deal when it first comes out and then is suddenly no longer talked about. Any thoughts on this category?
Queer Eye lasted 7 seasons. I think that is, like,
All right.
Campfire idea.
But it didn't become an institution. Like the ones in this category, candles. Okay, kindling, campfire, candles. It burns steady and long and becomes eventually a fixture, like a lighting fixture. Very few people here, especially here, will remember that South Park, when it began, was a huge thing that had all the earmarks of a thing that was going to burn out quickly, but it didn't because they kept putting in the work.
Or The Simpsons.
Exactly, like, that's my
we
next
were
one.
Very excited about Bart and Cowabunga.
Right.
Exactly.
And knew nothing of Dr. Hibbert. Like, there was so much ahead of us.
Anytime there is a novelty song associated with your property, do the Bartman, you assume fad. You assume this is going to go away. But it didn't. Again, it is no longer a much-discussed cultural moment, but it's still there.
The other thing that we wanted to make sure that we touched on was sometimes these fads, like, it's one thing when a fad is, like, a fictional thing, like a fictional person like David Pumpkins. But Guy, you also talked about the phenomenon of like a fad that's a person or a person getting treated like a fad.
I am in love with the comparative phenomena of Paris Hilton and Kim Kardashian. Paris Hilton came into our lives. We did not need her. She started out as like heiresses are dancing on tables, which was a thing that we had articles about. And then she worked to build that into something. And then we made her go away. We no longer needed her. She no longer provided us with value. And we were like, we are done. Kim Kardashian started out I realize that this is NPR, but she started out in a video with Brandy's brother. Like, she started out in, like, the most pop culture adjacent of places, and then she
did... A surreptitious boudoir recording.
She did the hard work of providing us with value we did not know we needed. Somebody has to endorse Midori. And I really respect the fact that she understood that, like, if you're going to keep that flame going, you have to provide it with fuel. And for all of us who want to say, I wish those Kardashians would go away, you have to understand, we made Paris Hilton go away. You can do it. But those Kardashians have proved themselves eminently scalable. We always have the number of sisters that we need.
Right.
And hardworking, like doing things like...
Entrepreneurial.
Fitting themselves into structures that we have with stuff like, you know, Chloe going on Celebrity Apprentice. I think they do masterful work.
I have on my phone right here, my favorite app is Kimoji.
Wow.
Exactly.
That was terrifying silence. I don't know if that was icy silence. It was dry. It was dry.
Shocked. Maybe just shocked. Shocked silence about the Kimoji.
What do you think it is that gives that initial shock of a fad? What is it that allows something to sort of like occupy conversation so hard?
I think it has to have like a slight sense of the weird. For some reason, I keep going back to David S. Pumpkins. But I think... I think if it doesn't have something that makes people sort of think that it's really weird, it won't last. And in fact, I even think that's true, even if you go all the way back, seriously, to like, where's the beef? Like, the thing that was weird about that was that it was in commercials. You didn't necessarily see at that time, like, the sassy grandma who comes up and is all angry all the time. And so, you know, it was kind of a funny, odd, and her delivery was funny and odd. And I think it has to have, like, a jolt of weirdness, and that's what makes it take off. But also, I think now, in the age that we're in now, it really helps for it to be changeable, scalable, alterable, editable.
Yeah.
Like, if you take something that has elements that you can swap out for other elements, I think that helps things become fads because everybody can say, I'm going to make my version of this. It's like this, except... with dogs, or like it's like this, except with public radio. Like, and you see, I think anything that has a swap out element, I think now it really helps.
If you Google David S. Pumpkins, and I have, you will find like we put David S. Pumpkins in horror movies. David S. Pumpkins, like pumpkins themselves, will disappear in the span of days. By the time this episode drops, we should probably explain what David S. Pumpkins is.
I think it's a mixture of several things. Novelty is huge, as you guys have mentioned, but there's also has to be a collective knowing and very prideful embrace of a note of defiance. Like, we embrace this thing, and we know that it's, if not silly, then at least unserious. You know, you embrace a thing in the moment of that, the moment a fad hits, to say to people, possibly your parents, this is the thing I love. It's not irony, but it travels in the same circus.
Saying fads are America's camp?
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's a good way of putting it.
It's like all of us together sort of like taking this thing that we understand is ridiculous but has charm to it. But I feel like camp should be magical and evergreen. Its badness should preserve it and allow its goodness to be there, where fads really are something that have an arc and burn out.
Yeah, because, okay, so there's always going to be a new thing that is the thing that you love that your parents don't understand.
Parents just don't understand.
And, you know, I think it's closer to nerdery than it is to irony.
Or slang, almost.
Yeah.
Like, it's part of a language. Like, I have a 12-year-old daughter, and she started using the word dank.
Mm-hmm.
And I look out into the crowd, I see some young people. And possibly some parents. I still have no idea what she means.
Oh, it's adorable.
Yeah. yeah, I think...
Well, it sounds bad, but I think it's supposed to be good.
No.
See, when kids today say bad, they mean good.
But here's another angle. I think also, again, I would blame this on or credit it to the social media aspect of this, which is I also think there's now an industry in waiting, in creating the fad almost so you can wait for the exact moment when you become cool by starting the backlash. Like, you, what you want is you want to be like the first backlash person. And sometimes there's an opportunity to be the first backlash to the backlash person.
Oh, yeah.
So I think fads now also flame up almost to create, it's like everything has that wave goes out, wave comes back
right.
in thing. And I often feel with a lot of things, like a lot of waves only exist because the pulling back in is something people enjoy. If you look at something like, if you look at something like Sharknado, you know, that I often talk about things having an irony multiplier, which is what's the part of the audience that's watching ironically or negatively or to make fun of the thing. You have a lot of things now that have irony multipliers of like 8 or 10,
mm-hmm.
where for however many people are like, I'm going to watch Sharknado, I think that's going to be a fun movie. Like, way more people are like, nah, I'm going to be the person who makes the best Sharknado joke on Twitter. You won't be. So I think fads also have that quality of, like, the fad exists almost for the entertainment of all the people who are like, oh, my God, I'm so over this. Your joke, you know, the classic tweet now is, like, your joke about this is not funny, mm-hmm. you know, which is, to me, always wants, you know, makes me want to sort of say, like, your scold about this is not fresh. Like.
Well, I think there is sort of this half-life at this point where you the life of some fads is fad launched into the world to first think piece written about fad.
Right.
And that is the length in which the fad is relevant. And once the think piece has been written,
right.
it's gone.
But Linda, Sharknado is such an interesting example for the tide going in and out. First of all, the fact that the sharks are not in a tide.
Right.
They're in a tornado. but secondly, because it is something that was, from the beginning, so bad that you can't turn on Sharknado.
Right.
No, but there was, so there, I think there was originally a time when sci-fi wanted those movies to actually be like B movies that were kind of like, you know, Dino Shark versus whatever. And like, they were bad, but they weren't as self-knowing.
Right.
They weren't like as self-aware as like Sharknado 4 was.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I think the more self-aware, Sharknado 4 was very self-aware. The more self-aware they become, the less fun they become. And I think
yeah.
that's true of most fads. And I will say, the more I get the sense that something is created for the purpose of, like, it's going to be a meme, it's going to be a thing, like, the less likely I am to connect to it. And I have felt that way all the way back to, like, Seinfeld and Sex and the City, mm-hmm. trying to drop little phrases that you could tell they were trying to, like, get people to pick up and
she
say, like,
man hands.
Exactly.
Man
yada,
hands.
Yada, yada. Like, it's.
And now we've come to trumped up trickle down, which is just so manufactured that no one's ever going to take it.
No, absolutely. I think that's right. And that is how I feel whenever I see something that you can just tell is, like, created to be.
Yeah. Well, getting back to your question about the difference between a meme and a fad, it seems to me that Tumblr exists. The engine that drives Tumblr is the burning of memes for fuel. And I think the distinction is a meme is shared, but a fad is embraced. Like the bar mystic is like clicking, oh, this is funny, a little heart. That is a meme.
The way you said heart
yeah.
is, I think, the way you talk about actual human
yeah,
hearts.
Yeah. But I mean, going back, this is Ask Your Parents, but Mood Rings and Pet Rocks were put mm-hmm. out into the world intentionally to be dumb.
Right.
And they were embraced.
Yeah.
Because, and I think, in the 1970s, we did not have think pieces. Nobody was writing about the Mood Ring in a kind of, let's figure this out kind of way.
You
so it lasted longer than it would
yeah.
ever do today.
Well, also the difference is that a fad is something that has the potential to go everywhere. It can go big, but the danger is a fad will hit your dad. Like, eventually,
yeah.
your dad will say, who let the dogs out? And you're like, all right, this is over.
Yeah. I have killed many fads for my children.
Okay, here's something I want to talk about, is the experience of liking or loving something and then having Linda's fad wave wash over it. Because I have, like...
By the way, Linda's fad wave is the name of my hair salon.
Like Linda, I am an attorney, in parentheses, non-practicing, and so a deep obsession with the life and work of Ruth Bader Ginsburg is something that had always been deep in my soul. And then we get the notorious RBG meme, and then suddenly it is a thing that everybody is sassily excited about. And it's like, no, you don't know. Like, you don't... You never read Martin Ginsburg's speech to the Tenth Circuit about that tax case that they did together.
Right.
And that experience of having a fad potentially, and Glenn, nerddom has experienced this so much over the course of the past 10 years, where there is this fear of fad washing over and destroying this cultural space that you love.
Oh, of course, yeah. That's what nerdery is us saying, this is ours, and it's not yours. And, you know, the whole thing of nerd culture is, you don't like the thing that I love in precisely the same way for exactly the same reasons that
right.
I do, therefore you're doing it wrong.
And you didn't do the work. A lot
you
of this,
didn't
is,
do the
this
work.
Is not that different from, like, I loved this band before. Like, I saw this band when they were playing in the back of a, you know, bowling alley and blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing, basically.
But the kind of embrace that a fad gets is a mile wide and an inch thick. It's not deep and pervasive. It's of the moment. It's collective. And then it goes away.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Blue Headphones. For 20 years, your favorite artists have used Blue microphones in the studio. Now Blue's unique headphone design brings the sonic truth to your ears so you can hear more in your favorite music. Find out why Esquire magazine called them the perfect headphones. Visit the store at bluedesigns.com and use coupon code NPR2017 for a special price. Blue, hear more.
All this month, we're asking you to tell a friend about a podcast that they're going to love. Think about your friend. Think about your mom. Think about anyone that you're close to. Do they not have a favorite podcast? Well, you can help. We're asking you to recommend something to them and then tell us what you did. You can hashtag that at TryPod. That's TryPod. Let us know what recommendations you made, and maybe we can pass them on to somebody else.
Our next topic, we crowdsourced some questions, some requests for pop culture advice. And we're going to answer some of those questions today, as we have been on every stop on this tour. Here's our first one from Grace in New York. My dad is telling me to stop watching and reading reviews of movies and television I haven't seen yet. His reason is that I haven't formed my own opinions about the piece yet, and I should experience them for myself before I watch or read what others have said. What are your thoughts? I would be really curious to know how old this person is.
Yeah.
I assume she's not like 40. I assume
right.
It's not like, my dad's constantly calling me up. Honey?
It sounds like her dad is like lording over her, like, while you're under my roof, you will not be reading the New York Review of Books. You know, it's just odd. Look, if this man's view of the world stuck, I would be out of a job.
Yeah.
It's like, because the thing about service journalism is that it provides a service. It does help you decide what you want to experience and what you don't. I will give her a little bit of advice, which is if you are reading a review and it starts to give away plot, and it keeps giving away plot, you can stop reading that because that, A, spoilers, but B, that critic doesn't have anything interesting to say about whatever they're reviewing. I've edited a lot of reviews, I've written a lot of reviews, and when you are stuck, you fill space by plot description.
Yeah.
Ideally, a review should just give you a sense of what it's about and then talk about what it's actually about,
yeah.
what it actually means. But I think it's a useful thing, and I think you need to go through life. There's too much out there in the world, as we have discussed many times, and you will come to trust certain critics. You will not read everything. There's no point in reading everything out there about something before you see it or read it or watch it or anything, but you will come to trust certain people, not because their aesthetic necessarily aligns with yours, but because you know their aesthetic.
Right. You're eventually going to have to develop the skill of understanding that your tastes are different from other people's tastes and that there are elements of criticism that are relatively objective, I think,
mm-hmm.
and there are elements of it that are incredibly subjective. And you're going to have to get used to, at some point, knowing that the fact that somebody else likes something doesn't mean you're necessarily going to agree with them. And I don't know that it does any good necessarily as a youngish person, who I think maybe this person is, to try to avoid that conflict, because you're going to run into it anyway. And I don't know that by coming to things fresh, you automatically save yourself from experiencing that conflict. Because there have been tons of times when I've seen something, liked it, and then read a negative review and been like, it still happens. Like, even if you see the thing first and read the review after.
How do you even know how to come to the thing to decide whether you like it or not without the guidance of people you trust?
Well, that's the consumer guide aspect. That's the service journalism aspect.
Well, and how frequently are we really going into things with no preconceptions? I mean, should we not watch trailers either? Like, Linda, you're someone who frequently watches films at festivals, and I always wonder, there are some films where I am like, God, I wish I could have watched this knowing nothing about it. I wish this could have just washed over me.
Yep.
Is that a good experience?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. There have been things at festivals, and of course, nothing's going to come to mind right now, unfortunately, but there have been movies at festivals that I knew almost nothing about, that watching them, not knowing anything about them, was probably a different experience in a positive way than if I had known a lot about it going in, just because you really sometimes don't even know what kind of movie it is until you start watching it, you know. But yeah, I think there's some validity to that.
I deeply love reading reviews both before and then reading the same review afterwards, because it's fun to engage with somebody else's opinion.
Right.
And with the rise of the recap, the culture changed because I don't ever go to a recap before I've seen the thing. The recap is about experiencing we're sharing the experience of watching or experiencing the thing and having a deeper discussion, or at least a one-way discussion, with the critic about what that show's about.
Yeah. All right, so our next question comes from Deb in St. Paul. I love this. I love this opening line. I love this lead. It was easier for me to come out as gay than as a non-Harry Potter fan. Not sure if there is a question here, but wondered if others felt the same way. And my response to this was, I think there is a question here, and it has something to do with sort of how to feel perfectly okay about not loving something that everybody else is paying a lot of attention to. What do you think, Guy?
For me, it always comes back to sophisticated music, like Radiohead, like those things that people use as just sort of like a shibboleth of, are you a valuable person? And I think it's really hard when people just have this sort of like, when there is this hegemony of, you're not allowed to disagree with this. There are honestly so many good reasons to dislike Harry Potter. I love Harry Potter, and it is for four aspects of it, but then you read that play and you realize this lady can't write dialogue. But I think it is that real fear that you're being left out and that people are judging you.
Right.
I think one of the things you should do is just sort of interrogate yourself where this is coming from. If it's reflexive contrarianism, just understand that dumping on a thing that everybody loves but you is not inherently interesting.
Yeah.
And it is certainly not a personality.
Yeah.
I think in our teenage years, we mistake, because as we've talked about this many times, but as you grow up and become a teenager, you define yourself in many ways by what you do not like.
Right.
And then you figure out what you like. But that's my take on this. I mean, I have some experience with this. let's do it this way. My name is Glenn. Now you say, hi, Glenn. I am a middle-aged gay man who hates the Golden Girls. I'm the one.
I looked around the audience just in time to see one person do this, which is exactly what I did the first time Glenn told me that. I went, I think if you find the show where Glenn first told us this, you hear three people on the mics go,
Glenn, is this reactive to the lower middle brow, saturation of gay guys talking about Golden Girls, or was this true in 1988?
It was true in 1988. I just didn't think it was funny. I thought it was broad. I thought it was just call and response. It was too flat.
The theme song is "Thank You for Being a Friend."
Yeah,
I'm not necessarily surprised that you're not a Golden Girls person.
And the fact that it is universally embraced is a thing that it's just become this shibboleth, as you say, and I don't react to it. But I don't go around saying that a lot. I'd say it when it comes up in this, because here's a thing that I think, and this is going to sound like...
What about Designing Women?
Same thing. Hated it. Here's the thing that this is going to sound
wrong.
Yeah. that is going to sound like dumping on millennials. This is actually just me being old. But basically, there is a beauty in the unexpressed opinion. Being able to articulate why you do not like a thing or do like a thing, but not feeling that it is part of your identity to keep saying it.
Right.
There is a majesty in that restraint, and that is a learned restraint because teenagers just want to tell you what they think about and everything. Being an adult means not harshing people's mellow by your dumbass opinions.
But I think honestly, as you're growing up, I do think it's a very natural thing to, like, that push back and forth of, like, when you're sitting around in college, for example, what else are you going to do?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? You sit around fighting about the Golden Girls and designing women because it's that or study.
Right.
You know?
But also, how you feel about a TV show is not a hill to die on.
No,
of
course.
It's not your personality.
Sure.
Of course.
You know,
and we disagree on many things.
We
and
do.
I disagree with many things about probably everybody on this panel and everybody I'm friends with.
Yeah, I guess I'm surprised that the person is struggling so much to sort of come out as a non-Harry Potter fan. I feel like every friend group has, like, that one person who will die on the hill of, like, Phil Collins was better in Genesis than Peter Gabriel. Like, Thursday night must-see TV, best show, Caroline in the City. Like, there's always that one person.
Steven, I think Paul McCartney did his best work in Wings.
Exactly. I'm really surprised that this person hasn't just embraced it.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Match, where you can find the meaningful connection you are looking for. Match is number one in first dates and also in second dates. Plus, finding your someone is easier when you download their mobile app. Get your matches sent directly to your phone. For Pop Culture Happy Hour listeners, go to match.com/pop to get 7 days completely free to search and connect on Match today.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. We are now going to talk to our friend Petra Mayer, who had a chance to talk to author Neil Gaiman. Petra, tell us what you talked to Neil Gaiman about.
Well, after I sort of stilled my beating fangirl heart, we talked about his new book, Norse Mythology, which is his take on the Norse myths.
Which is very timely because we've got American Gods coming out very soon.
The television series.
The television
right.
series, where, no spoilers, but knowing your Norse mythology will help you while watching that series.
Right. And reading this book may also give you some new perspectives on, like, the spate of Marvel movies,
mm-hmm.
the never-ending sort of spate of Marvel movies that are coming out that are set in Marvel's version of Asgard.
Oh, wonderful. All right. We are going to listen to this conversation between Petra and Neil Gaiman. So let's take a listen.
So I know you grew up reading comics. So which came first for you, the Marvel Thor or the one from the Eddas?
Marvel. Marvel's Thor came first. I was 6 years old in England, and I was reading the reprints mm-hmm. of Marvel's Thor in an English comic called Fantastic, which was great because it meant that I got to read Marvel's Thor from the beginning. Dr. Don Blake found this stick in a cave, banged it down, and transformed into Thor, and the stick transformed into the hammer, which meant that I spent most of the rest of my first decade banging any sticks that I found against the ground, just on the off chance that they might be the Thor stick, and might transform into a mighty hammer. None of them ever did. But very, very shortly after that, because now I was interested in Thor, I found Roger Lancelin Green's Myths of the Norsemen and loved it, was completely intrigued.
In situations like this, I always think about the concept of headcanon. You know, since you experienced the visual aspect of the Marvel comics first, did it affect how you, when you were reading the Eddas, did you have Marvel's Thor in your head?
No, I didn't. I went to Myths of the Norsemen to learn more about Marvel's Thor, and what I learned about was a completely different thing. It wasn't this sort of towering Jack Kirby, you know, science fiction-esque Asgard. It was a bunch of huts with a wall around them. You know, somewhere the Thor was now red-bearded, irritable, muscly, zooming around the sky in a chariot pulled by goats, and not necessarily the brightest hammer in the bag. And Loki was no longer a sort of god of mischief. Now he was something much more interesting. He was this unreliable friend and an unreliable enemy. You know, just this sort of weird character who lives with the gods, yet is not quite a god, but is going to cause them trouble.
He's sort of like Don John in Much Ado About Nothing. Now that you mention it, sort of not quite a god.
Exactly.
You say
not quite of them.
Yeah. You say in the introduction that it's Ragnarok that really makes this Norse myth stick in your head. Why is that?
I think the biggest reason is because it turns the entire thing into a tragedy, which gives it depth. It gives it bass notes. It gives it a peculiar profundity. It also means that it becomes immediate. As you read about Ragnarok, you can always look out of your window and go, is that happening now? Is that going to happen? The gods, even at their funniest, you know that this is waiting for them. And I think that's, when I was a kid, that fascinated me. Most Armageddon scenarios, you know, even the New Testament Armageddon scenarios, you may have a lot of angels fighting each other, but nobody says, and then God is going to die battling Satan, and they're both going to tumble into the pit, and, you know, people are going to have to figure out what to do on their own, mm-hmm. which would be really rather interesting, and you're not given that. But the Norse, you are. Is Odin killed fighting the wolf? Is Thor killed by the Midgard serpent? Is Heimdall and Loki, who've always hated each other, finally falling in battle with each other? And that is that adds a sort of very peculiar depth to the entire operation.
It did hang over my head as I was reading it, the knowledge that that was coming, which sort of makes me wonder, where do you think we are now? Are we the golden chess pieces? Has Ragnarok already happened, or is it coming?
Somebody last night, I did an event at the town hall, and one of the questions from the audience was, are we yet at peak Ragnarok? Which I loved. It's like, yes, there was peak oil and peak Ragnarok. And I said, I do not yet believe we are yet in peak Ragnarok. I think we are. We are, if anything, in the very early days. But then Ragnarok, like all Armageddons, I think is mostly personal. You're all on a ride to the end of the world.
The other thing that stuck out to me reading this was you talk about all the missing pieces. So I guess I have kind of the dreaded two-part question. What was it like taking this disjointed mass of stories with all these missing pieces and putting it together into a narrative? And what missing piece do you wish most was there? What story would you like to read?
I would love to read, you know, we have all of these wonderful goddesses. There's Sofon and there's Var. And the idea that you had a doctor of the gods, I think, in terms of the giant list of missing pieces, is the one I find most interesting of all.
Oh, my
because
God.
Because I go, I would love to read the story. It's as if all of the stories that are lost are women stories. They're all stories about goddesses in which goddesses have agency. And you go, they have to have been there because here are all the goddesses. And I do not believe that the women did not tell these stories, but we don't have any of them, which is fine. We know that we only have a tiny percentage of the stories. But the story of the Doctor of the Gods, I would have loved to have found out about her. The other part of your question is, what was really interesting for me was picking stories as I went that felt like they added to the narrative and felt like they were all on this slow walk to doomsday. And felt like that if I left them out, you wouldn't get quite the same experience. And there were some where I'd look at the story and I go, well, this is a really good story, but it's just a little bit too rapey, a little bit too, doesn't quite work for the whole thing. Or it's exactly like another story. So.
And how much, which sort of makes me wonder, because I felt like I heard some of the rhythms of your writing and your dialogue in some of the things that the gods were saying to each other. How much of you is in these stories?
I felt like I was allowed to write. All of the dialogue is pretty much me. A lot of the local color and the detail is me. I wound up quite often researching how things worked in Viking times. Going, okay, I know that we have a builder, master builder, and a horse. But how did you use a horse to get large blocks of stone from a quarry to the place you're building, and discover, you use a stone boat. It's kind of like a sled. That's, and researching Viking-era stone boats, researching Viking wildflowers, researching mead-making techniques. So that stuff, I would then come in as sort of as local color. And the dialogue was me. And sometimes letting the dialogue be funny was me too.
My childhood myth book was Dolaire's Greek Mythology, you know, with the beautiful pastel illustrations. So I never got familiar with the Norse myths until I sort of started working on this book and this interview. So it's really been a wonderful experience for me to read them, especially in your voice. And thank you so much for talking to me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for such fun questions.
Oh, you know how to flatter an interviewer. Thank you again.
Thank you. Bye-bye, Petra.
Bye-bye.